including, and thank you so much for turning out in such significant numbers for what will be, I'm sure, an excellent evening. Many of you must feel as I do, which is sort of demob happy. We're almost there. The term is almost finished. But this is very much last but not least. And it's a great privilege for me to welcome John here this evening. I have read his work for many, many years and been a huge admirer of it. I think it combines great historical subtlety and understanding with conceptual rigor. And these are two qualities which are fairly rare, especially in American political science these days, and rare generally, I think. And so I'm much looking forward to his talk. We invited him here this evening because of some of the articles you've already published in this area, particularly the foreign policy piece and debates I know you've had with people like Bob Kagan and others who were, of course, here earlier this year. So this is the last lecture in our series on American power in the 21st century. For those of you who were not here last time, the first set of lectures, public lectures on economic globalization and global governance, which started with Joe Stiglitz and ended with Bob Cohen, are now available in the bookshop as a terrific little book called Taming Globalization, Frontiers of Governance. And it's a very short book, not exactly summer reading, but short and sharp. And the standards of the pieces and the arguments are very good. And it tries to, as a whole, the book to set out a sort of progressive agenda for thinking about globalization and economic governance. This set of lectures, American Power in the 21st Century, will also appear in a volume, but not until last lecture is over, and not until sometime early next year. Slothful as we publishers are, I say that because in another life I'm also a publisher. But some reason we never understood it. The Europeans can produce books in 6 weeks, from manuscript to publication, and we think we're doing a great job, and we can do it in 6 to 7 months. And frankly, I've never understood how they can do it so quickly and we can't. But that's an aside. Next academic year, the theme of the third set of Miliband public lectures will be on culture in the age of global communications. And we'll explore some massive contemporary themes about the clash of culture, so-called clash of civilizations, and so on. And we hope to make it really interesting by not just having some outstanding figures here from across the academic world, but to have some people who are leading performers in film and music who have also contributed to this actual constellation of culture and communication we live with today. So we'll be announcing the details of that early next term. John Eikenberry is Peter F. Crow, thank you. I've been working on that all afternoon and seeking advice, but blew it anyway. Professor of Geopolitics and Global Justice, great combination of terms there, at Georgetown University, with an appointment in both the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service and the Government Department. It's interesting how departments seem to become very undistinguished when they no longer have a name attached to them, but it's a very distinguished department indeed. He's also the first director of the Montara Center for International Affairs at Georgetown University, which was inaugurated in January 2003. Professor Eikenberry recently completed a volume called After Victory, Institutions, Strategic Restraint, and the Rebuilding of Order After Major Wars, which was published by Princeton University Press. And he's the author, editor of many, many volumes, and just choosing a few titles at random, Reasons of State, Oil Politics and the Capacities of American Government, the State and American Foreign Economic Policy. There should be long commas after these and a pause. It's not all one title. New Thinking in International Relations, and most recently an edited volume, American Unrivaled, The Future of the Balance of Power. He's working also on, what is your current book?
The Politics of Unipolarity.
The Politics of Unipolarity, the theme more or less of tonight's lecture. Among many other activities, Professor Eikenberry chaired a study group on democracy and discontent at the Council on Foreign Relations, served as a senior staff member on the Carnegie Commission on the Reorganization of Government for the Conduct of Foreign Policy, and has lectured widely throughout the United States, Europe, and Asia. I thank him very much for touching down here this evening, and welcome him with me, please.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
great to be here and to be part of this Miliband lecture series. Ralph Miliband's work was part of my intellectual upbringing at the University of Chicago, where I took my PhD, and so it's an honor to be part of this series and to follow the distinguished group that that has lectured on American power this spring. I am a kind of veteran of the wars of between those of us who are more or less international liberals and the neocons. So I'm somewhat wounded and maybe a little blood coming dripping from me. But it's good to be here to think back on the debates of the last year as the United States presents these interesting behaviors to the world, and we all try to figure out what's going on and evaluate them and assess their significance. My work, as David suggested, is really over the years been focused on international order, its logic, its character, how it's changed over the historical eras, and the distinctive way in which the United States has attempted to use its power over the last century in building international order. These questions have been given a new urgency because of the rise of American unipolar power. Never has one state been so powerful relative to the rest of the world. This is a surprising development. When we began the post-Cold War era, most of us anticipated the emergence of something that might be called a multipolar world of more or less equal great powers. But development surprised us. Through the 1990s, the United States began the decade as the world's only superpower, and it had a better decade than the other great powers. Between 1990 and 1998, the U.S. GNP grew 28%, Europe grew 16%, and Japan grew 6%. It actually did grow in between recessions. Defense spending also is part of unipolarity. The U.S. spends roughly the amount of the next 14 countries combined, and if current projections hold, it will spend equal to the rest of the world together by the year 2007. It has troops in dozens of countries, bases in over 50 countries. Its economy is equal to the next three combined. No wonder the French have coined the term hyperpower, and in a slightly softer version, Chris Patton has said, the United States is not just a superpower, but a super-duper power. It has a slightly kinder and gentler sound, doesn't it? And no wonder, as well, that scholars are dusting off terms like empire, hegemony, hierarchy to try to make sense of this new system. For 20 years, scholars in my field have been debating the implications of anarchy. Countries behave in this anarchic order and have patterns based on that order of anarchy. Now we are really trying to figure out how do countries behave in an order described or characterized by hierarchy, where you don't have that kind of decentralized system, but you have this one large country, what Joseph Joffe has called Mr. Big. Now, various factors have created this situation where we have a Mr. Big and intensified these power asymmetries. The collapse of Russia after the Cold War, China's own developmental pathway, which is still very much at the early stage. It's a developing country. It has problems ahead of it. Japan, to the surprise of all of us, has not been able to overcome its decade of malaise and is a long-term declining great power. And the European Union is gathering its forces, but it is clearly inward-looking and is not capable of projecting power on the global stage. All of that is part of the story of power, new power asymmetries. The loss of the Cold War threat and the Soviet counterpower to the United States has also, in some sense, relinquished or taken away one of the great restraints on American power. Moreover, no rival political ideology really has emerged on the global stage as an alternative to the rough kind of American ideology and agenda. And then more recently, U.S. projection of power. In Kosovo, more recently in Afghanistan, and now very recently in Iraq, has also put on display American power. It suggested that there really is this new possibility of harnessing military technologies to engage in regime change that can be contemplated because the casualties on both sides are not what ordinarily would be entailed in this kind of major conquest. In some sense, the use of power by America has created power, an old argument made by Machiavelli. It has created reputation for power and created new realities that have intensified this unipolarity. And then finally, the Cold War system of client states, of security dependencies, is still in place, despite the end of the Cold War. Key countries in every region of the world are still reliant on U.S. security protection. And in most cases, there are not good alternatives in sight. Think of Japan, clearly in a geopolitical box. It may resent or bridle at American power and the kind of exercise of power, particularly in the recent era, but it doesn't have very many alternatives. All of these aspects of this new situation intensify unipolarity. So we're asking basic questions about what is the character of unipolarity and its future. I think four questions are most important that have to be answered, and I hope to take a stab at each of these this evening. Number one, what is the character of American domination? If all domination on the global stage is a combination or a mix of consent and coercion, is that mix shifting away from consent towards coercion? Number two, what are the restraints on U.S. power? That is to say, what disciplines U.S. power? What makes it predictable, if anything? Thirdly, how tied is the United States to international rules and institutions? That is to say, does unipolarity actually negate or select away from rule-based order? Does it, as I would like to pose the question this evening, does unipolarity select for unilateralism? Does unipolarity select for or give incentives to generate unilateralism? So how tied is the United States to rules and institutions? And then finally, how stable is unipolarity? Is balancing, resentment, backlash, a kind of forceful response that brings the system to the ground likely to arise? How inevitable is that counterbalancing dynamic? These are basic questions that engage our most important and enduring theories of politics and international relations. And indeed, the most pressing question of them all, and really the great political question of our time, is the question of what are the implications of unipolarity for multilateralism and rule-based order. Now, over the last 2 years, this question has been on the tip of everybody's tongue around the world as we've watched the Bush administration, asking the question, is the United States making a fundamental shift away from its post-war commitment to multilateralism and an orientation based on leadership embedded within institutions? Clearly, a long list of rejections of agreements would suggest there's evidence for making this thesis that it is. The rejection of the Kyoto Protocol, the ICC, the light weapons ban, the ABM treaty, and now the most provocative act by America really in half a century perhaps, a preemptive war in Iraq without international consensus, indeed over the opposition of many of its key allies. Richard Holbrooke, the former ambassador to the United Nations under the Clinton administration, charged the Bush administration as threatening to, quote, a radical break with 55 years of bipartisan tradition that sought international agreements and regimes to benefit all. Indeed, many of us see and traveling around and talking to people who observe American power, there's a general sense, a kind of uneasiness that the United States is in some sense out of control. Or as one diplomat who I met in Bratislava several weeks ago said, the United States is kind of wild right now. Why? Well, two factors, two new realities have made this part of the new unipolarity that we know today. One is, of course, the presence of terrorism and the attacks of 9/11, which have mobilized American power, and mobilized American power towards a kind of nebulous threat that is not contained or embedded in a different great power. That is to say, it's mobilized power that has not generated a counter-mobilizing power. It's the first time in American history when an American president has called the nation to action and mobilized resources and military power without targeting another great power. It's not Nazism or communism or fascism. It's terrorism. At most, it's rogue states. But this has created both power that has not been matched by others, and it's created new divisions among the major states, among even the major democratic states, on what the nature of the threats are. The other reality, which is my main focus tonight, is the rise of unipolarity, giving the United States opportunities to disentangle itself from post-war rules and institutions, and generating a kind of basic unsettling or uneasiness in world politics. Indeed, much of the world thinks that we may be engaged in witnessing a basic transformation in an international order from an old order which we've known and lived within for 50 years at least, namely what I would call hegemonic order with liberal characteristics. Hegemonic order with liberal characteristics. That is to say, order built around multilateralism, alliance, tight alliance partnership, strategic restraint, cooperative security, and institutional cooperation. To something that might be called hegemonic order with imperial characteristics, that is to say, order built around unilateralism, coercion, reduced commitment to shared and agreed upon rules of the game, perhaps emblematic of this imperial turn being the national security strategy, which pronounces to the world an intention for the United States to really muster a military power that will end the need for other great powers to ever really engage in military competition. As George Bush said at his West Point speech last June, a year ago, that the United States was going to become so preeminent in military power that traditional great power rivalry would end, and now the major countries would simply compete on things like trade and pasta wars and tuna and fishing rights. The old geopolitical struggles would end because the United States would be so powerful and stand above the rest of the world, enforcing its will as a kind of global policeman. So that's the face of the new hegemonic order with imperial characteristics. And this turn to many people seems to be so profound that it's going to rend the basic foundations of the West, in addition to the larger international order, that a basic split is emerging between Europe and the United States. And you do see articles written by scholars, Charles Kupchan and others, talking about the end of the West, the end of the Atlantic order. Europe continuing to be committed to multilateralism and rule-based order, the United States trying to reassert its desire to reacquire its autonomy and reclaim its sovereignty. Francis Fukuyama has made the argument that that this new split generated by power has gone on to expose a basic difference between the Europeans and the Americans on the source of legitimacy for liberal democracy. Europe, the source of legitimacy, is rooted in the international system, and states acquire it, share it, pool it, and there's a natural inclination and ability based on that conception of sovereignty to move up and down between internal states, and trans-state forms of organization. Whereas as the United States, sovereignty and legitimacy is rooted in the national constitution. International organizations can borrow that sovereignty, but they can't have it, and we will reclaim it. And now the argument is that the United States is in such a powerful position that it can make good on that desire. Or to pose the question before I move to my argument as grandly as I can, it's a very grand room, I would pose the question this way. Is U.S. unipolarity, that is to say the most extreme disparities in the distribution of power in modern world history, consistent with rule-based order? That, I think, is the basic question that all of us have to ask. My argument is unipolarity is indeed consistent with multilateralism and rule-based order, that even powerful states have deep and enduring incentives to construct and operate in a world of rules and institutions. The best image of what is going on today, in my view, is not an image of the United States using its power to shed multilateral obligations and destroy rule-based order, an image that is shared, by the way, by both the neocons and the French. A better image is, in my view, the U.S. using its rising power trying to renegotiate the existing rule-based order. But at the end of that cycle, there will be rules and institutions that will be as dense and as important and as agreed upon as those we have now. What's odd about this current process of rising power, socioeconomic change, political crisis, renegotiation, and then at the end a kind of recrystallization of rules and institutions, is that it's the United States, in effect, asking the world to renegotiate its own post-war order. The image we have in our head when we think about this process of rising power and a renegotiated order is a different great power rises up. Germany at the turn of the century, or before that Britain, or before that the Dutch. That is to say, a kind of rising state that uses its power to risk control of the rules of the game from the waning great power that it's replacing. The oddity is it's the United States replacing itself. It's the image, if you will, of the United States looking at its own house that it built with its own blueprints and now saying, well, we want another wing over here, or we don't want you here, we want you up there, or we want to have these new rules in this house. So it's difficult to perceive this, but it's an image which is very different, with very different implications than the other image I suggested. So I want to argue this evening the thesis that unipolar power and the order we see before us is in fact relatively stable. In fact, it's a durable political formation. American power, as I hope I will show, is sufficiently benign not to trigger counterbalancing coalitions, yet U.S. power advantages are sufficiently robust, multidimensional, and rooted in the global structures of modernity to last for decades. At worst, we are looking at rising conflict and a kind of domesticated power politics among democratic states who believe that the resort to violence or force to settle disputes is unthinkable, and strategic rivalry is unlikely. That is new. That's not the world of the post-war Cold War era where we had tight agreement and a kind of harmonious set of relations and high expectations about how we would settle our differences. More power will be deployed across the Atlantic and around among the great powers, but among states where the old ways of settling business, threatening force, are no longer plausible. That is an interesting new type of order, great power politics within a security community. And I would suggest that's the conception that is helpful in describing and analyzing what is new. Now, I want to do four things here in the next 30 or 40 minutes. I want to talk about how U.S. unipolar power is manifest today, talk about underlying characteristics of American power that make it robust and enduring, talk about the emerging strategies for dealing with unipolarity, and then at the very end, return to my basic question about why the United States continues to have incentives to act multilaterally. Let me start with some observations that hopefully will allow you to see where I'm coming from. First, opening observation. Despite the rise of U.S. power, the great powers around the world have not sought to directly balance U.S. power. History tells us the states don't like a world of one great power. Balance of power is the most enduring insight of international relations theories. And the great states of the past that have sought to dominate their world have all been checked by power by other states. Charles V, Louis XIV, Napoleon I, post-Bismarck, Germany, all had hegemonic ambitions and all were checked sooner or later. Yet this hasn't happened and doesn't appear likely to happen in the future that we can see today. Despite the collapse of the Soviet Union, despite huge shifts in the distribution of power, Europe and East Asia have not made fundamental shifts in their orientation towards the United States. Europe, Japan, the United States have all over the last 10, 15 years, and even in the most recent crisis, reaffirmed alliance ties, contained political conflict, expanded trade and investment, expanded ties, and avoided the return to strategic rivalry. And perhaps even more surprisingly, over the last 2 years, is the behavior of China and Russia, both of which have decided to move closer to the United States to integrate into this unipolar order rather than resist it. Russia is in a near alliance with the United States and integrated into the Western security framework, and China has dropped its rhetoric of hegemonism and is accommodating itself in ways that surprise every China specialist that I know. Overall, rather than edging away, much less balancing against the other governments of the world, the great powers of the world, have maintained patterns of engagement with the United States. Indeed, the main security concern in Europe and Asia is not how to distance from an all too powerful America, but how to prevent the United States from drifting away. One can make additional observations that have to do with why this might be so and looking at the character of America as a superpower. Let me make four observations. Number one, the U.S. is a different kind of superpower. It has a unique cluster of capacities, institutions, attractions, and impulses. And this is interesting because old kind of rhythmic theories of rise and decline and of the character of power and reaction don't work well because of these distinctive characteristics emanating from the United States. The U.S. power is manifest in complex and paradoxical ways. During the 20th century, the U.S. was the greatest champion of rule-based order, greater than Europe was, manifest in the League of Nations, the earlier the arbitration panels, pre-World War I, the United Nations, which was a U.S. project, human rights norms. All of these are aspects of America's impulse towards rulemaking in the 20th century, but it has also at the same time been unusually ambivalent about operating within those legal and institutional rules that it seeks to construct. Profoundly ambivalent, and as we see at various moments along the way, whether it's the League of Nations or various proposals for order after World War II, such as the International Trade Organization, that were rejected by the United States. Moreover, the U.S. has used force more times than any other state in the last 50 years, within and without, outside of U.S., UN, or NATO sanctions, yet it has a profoundly anti-imperial political culture and a healthy isolationist tradition. So it's difficult to paint the United States as a single way, having a single impulse, having a single political culture that supports a single grand strategy. It's much more heterogeneous and complex and indeed paradoxical. My point is that it's very difficult for other countries to simply decide to counter or work against the United States. It's difficult for countries to say, that's it. We now know what America is going to do. We don't like it. We are now going to begin our own project of counter-hegemonic coalition building. Another opening observation. Different countries and peoples experience American unipolar power differently. What is a threat to some is an opportunity to others. Moreover, there are different levels and types of power which generate reaction. I could think of at least three right off the bat. U.S. power as American capitalism, or manifest in its underwriting of the institutions and rules of globalization. This has fueled a certain type of politics that we associate with the anti-WTO movement or the anti-globalization movement more generally. That's one aspect of American power, and that's one politics of that power. A second level or type is U.S. power manifest as global political military alliance system. This is where the author Chalmers Johnson argues that there is growing blowback to the American so-called empire, which he uses quite casually. Some efforts to push the United States out of different regions. There is an agenda in South Korea, for example, to remove American troops. The little secret is that the neocons in Washington are all too eager to hear from Seoul that they want us to leave and we will leave on the first boat. They are eager to redeploy and are not likely to fight those sort of efforts at showing the America to the door. But that's the politics of the American alliance system. And then a third level or type is U.S. power as specific policies or issues. The status of forces agreements that U.S. has with all of its different host countries for its 50-country base system around the world, so-called SOFA, the status of forces agreements. The SOFA in many countries isn't very comfortable these days, and there's a politics of that. The Iraq policy is the most obvious one, where the resentment is to a type of policy, to a particular direction of policy, and the preemption doctrine, and perhaps not to the larger agenda that America puts its power in the service of. To conclude on this point, make a third point about American power, the face that American power shows the world matters. And this is where I come back to what I think are the two faces of American power that are in play today. U.S. hegemony with liberal characteristics, as I said, the old face of America, and this threatening face of American hegemony with imperial characteristics. My hypothesis is the greater the U.S. tilts towards liberal hegemony, the greater the incentives other states will have to engage and bandwagon, to use the term of art, American power. And the greater the U.S. tilts towards imperial forms of order, the more incentives there will be to resist and move away from the United States, a kind of baseline, simple, straightforward hypothesis. And I want to suggest why I think the liberal face of America will in the end triumph. Finally, most great powers today and states around the world are trying to figure out how to respond to unipolarity. It's fascinating to watch. And I would say, on balance, the policies that we see emerging fall between the extremes of either balancing, that's the old realist attempt to deal with power that's concentrated, or bandwagoning, which is embrace without reservation. States are resisting without balancing and engaging without simply acquiescing. During the Iraq crisis, two strategies seem to emerge: the Blair strategy of get close, look for ways to exert influence, and the Chirac strategy of build opposing political coalitions, put pressure on the United States by resisting it. My sense is that Europeans and others around the world feel that neither strategy has been fully successful. Countries are all learning, experimenting, seeking to find ways to cope with Mr. Big. Now let me turn to what I think are the underlying reasons why unipolarity is here for a long time. And I think there are four facets of American power that have to be contended with. The first is the most traditional, the realist way of looking at America. It's traditional power assets. That is to say, aspects of hegemony and hegemonic power emphasized by realist scholars such as Robert Gilpin. One could start with the sheer size of American military, which makes amassing countervailing military power very difficult. William Walforth at Dartmouth has made the argument that it's essentially impossible. Even if you want to do it, even if there's a demand for balancing, there isn't a supply for balancing. It can't be done because there aren't enough countries with enough countries that can plausibly be put together as a counter-coalition force that could make any difference. And this is exacerbated not only by the sheer disparities of power, but the dysfunctional aspects of trying to build countervailing alliances. Collective action problems. People want to do it, but they don't want to be the one that pays the price for doing it. We call that buck passing. We would like France to do it, but not us, or somebody else to do it, perhaps China. And the other problem that exacerbates the disparities of power is regional antagonisms. If any other great power decided it wanted to lead a charge against the United States by amassing power, it has regional rivals that are in the business of trying to block that power. That's true of China, that's true of Russia, that's certainly true of any state within Europe. So those are problems that come from the power dimension of American unipolarity. But the power dimension goes beyond that, and there are three additional aspects of the power advantage: security protection, markets, and nuclear weapons. Security protection, I simply mean what I referred to earlier. That is to say, with that power, the United States has provided alliance protection to a variety of key countries that gives those countries reasons to stay allied with the United States and make the alternatives incredibly costly. Germany and Japan have responded to this logic. Eastern European countries have responded to the logic as well. A desire not just for security protection, but for the politics that comes from that. Politics that in part has to do with providing a kind of Atlantic connection for Eastern European countries that worry about the big state problem within Europe. There's more than one Mr. Big if you are an Eastern European country, and the Atlantic, i.e. the unipolar logic, provides some insurance to the intra-European logic. Access to markets. This reduces incentives for Eastern European allies to push for regional security order against the United States. The logic of trade. The United States remains a major source of a destination for products. The American consumer, and therefore, in some sense, is underwriting the sort of the economic side of unipolarity through the importance of the American market for trade. And finally, nuclear weapons. This has an interesting implication for unipolarity. It takes great power war off the table. The mechanism in which old international orders were overturned across the centuries was war. As I suggested before, it was the image that's put forward by Gilpin of a rising state attempting to impose a new order on the world and often doing so through a hegemonic war. Well, that's not going to happen in the era of nuclear weapons. And that has a double-edged aspect to it. On the one hand, it makes the fact that other great powers have nuclear weapons makes conquest by the United States, that is to say, the hard edge of American power, less threatening to other countries, because the United States isn't going to invade other countries that have nuclear weapons. On the other hand, in that sense, it makes American power more muted. It takes the extreme manifestations of American power off the table, but it also, in some sense, locks the American system in for more decades than might otherwise be the case if war were on the table. geography, a second major dimension of and historical timing of American power. U.S. is a great power and the only great power that is not in a neighborhood that has other great powers. There are multiple implications of this. Geographical remoteness makes U.S. power less threatening to the rest of the world. It, moreover, has reinforced U.S. disinclination for direct domination or the management of great power relations. It's put the United States historically on the side of championing free trade or open markets, so the open door with China, because we are on the outside wanting to get in. We are looking for universal principles. And then finally, during the 20th century, this American offshore positioning of its power has made the politics of American power one where other countries have had to actively work to get America connected to their part of the world. It is what Geir Lundstad has called an empire of invitation, where other countries have been less worried about domination and more worried about abandonment. Thirdly, democracy and institutional restraint. This is what I have spent my last few years thinking about, the third dimension of U.S. power, namely that U.S. unipolar order is organized around democratic polities and a web of international institutions. And this has made American power more open, more penetrated, and more highly institutionalized. The implications are twofold. Number one, institutions and democracy at the domestic level creates access and voice opportunity, creates a politics of access within the American unipolar order, something that the Bush administration has resisted, but it's still there. And secondly, multilateral institutions create rules and binding ties that reduce arbitrary and indiscriminate exercise of power. So in effect, what the United States has done through the institutionalization of its power is created a kind of more predictable, routinized way in which other countries experience that power. And again, this has made American power different than great powers of the past. It's a curiosity, I think. I'll just end my discussion of that with one observation, and that is that the United States, through the middle part of the 20th century into today, has acted differently than other great powers in its inclination to build institutions. Other great powers in the past have not sought to maintain or exercise their power through such institutions. And that has an enduring implication, I think, that will persist beyond the Bush administration and continue to give stability to this order. Finally, I would say that the fourth dimension of American power is modernization and the civic character of its political identity. The basic point here is simply that I would make is that U.S. power is more acceptable to the rest of the world to the extent that its underlying project, the American project, is consistent with or congruent with the deeper forces of modernization. My argument is that there's a kind of basic synchronicity between the rise of U.S. power and its liberal face of hegemony and the wider system imperatives of modernization and advancement. That if American power were put at the service of dysfunctional system projects, if it were a fascist state, if it were a state that sought to impede basic forces of modernization, the resistance would be much greater. So there's a kind of wind to the back phenomenon to American power that's created by the fact that it is its society is aligned with, if you will, the larger trajectory of modernization. Now, let me turn to my third set of comments, which have to do with, well, what's the rest of the world doing about this? And here I would simply say that despite these features, countries are reacting, as well they should, trying to engage and resist American power. And indeed, you can see this by simply observing that the prestige or soft power of the United States has plummeted in recent months and in the last year, most importantly because of the Iraq War. The prestige and reputation of the United States has plunged around the world. Countries, politicians in various parts of the world have drawn upon this domestic unease with America for their own domestic political purposes. Schroeder in Germany, No in the recent election in South Korea, Lula in Brazil have all been victorious in national elections by drawing on, in some sense, this unease with American power. Around the world, governments are trying to figure out what sort of strategies might work to make U.S. power more ruly, more predictable, more restrained, more usable, user-friendly, if you will, more institutionalized. A few weeks ago, I had an occasion to talk with a Canadian diplomat who called me for some reason. I said, why have you on the phone? Sort of, what's going on, you know, in Canadian foreign policy these days? Or what's on your agenda? And the Canadian diplomat said, the same thing that's been on our agenda for four decades, how to make the United States more multilateral. So they've got a one agenda. When the Canadian diplomats go to the office in the morning, they have one thing in mind. How can we make America more ruly? And indeed, countries are experimenting with ways of dealing with this unipolar reality. And the term of art that's starting to make its way around scholars and pundits is the term soft balancing, something that entails resisting, trying to undercut the worst and sharpest edges of this unipolarity, but something short of the old form of balancing. And let me just sort of go through the exercise that I've been going through in the last few months of trying to figure out what these strategies are and just give you a taste of what I think is emerging out there. First, strategies of resistance, short of balancing. And by the way, if the two strategies that people in my business most talk about, balancing and bandwagoning, I felt it imperative that I find strategies that start with B. So my next strategy, short of balancing, is buffering, pulling back from the U.S. and creating political space. This is the goal of reducing vulnerability to American domination and uncertainty. Examples would include the Japan, the Asian Monetary Fund proposal of post-1997 Asian financial crisis. In the end, American power, but also resistance by China and some of the Southeast Asian countries doomed that proposal. But more generally and more recently in East Asia, the ASEAN Plus 3 initiative, which is a very interesting development in that region, which is, if you read it carefully, is an attempt to create a kind of political and economic space in East Asia without Anglos. That is to say, it will be the kind of intra-Asian oriental type of configuration with ASEAN countries plus China, South Korea, and Japan that will, in a sense, be a kind of buffer to American power by creating local standards that are, in the final instance, congruent with international standards, IMF and so forth, but nonetheless some sense of buffering. A second strategy of resistance, baiting. That actually took a fair amount of work to get this one. Developing a counter-regional or functional grouping that is designed to put pressure on or to lure the United States into eventually accepting those rules. The ICC is a good example. We'll go ahead without the United States, and then we will hope that a later administration or experience showing the success of this institution will bring the United States into that institution. By the way, over 70% of the American people in a German Marshall Fund poll support American participation in the ICC. So there's good reason to engage in baiting. Bargaining, good old-fashioned strategy of simply carrots and sticks. Some of it's just old-fashioned pulling and hauling, working through established institutions like the G7. Withholding cooperation is another form of bargaining. Saudi Arabia withholding or threatening to withhold basing rights. Basing rights is a key vulnerability to the unipolar order, and I wouldn't be surprised if countries start to look for that dependency that America has on outward locales as part of the pressure that might be used to negotiate with unipolarity. William Wallace, at one point, I read a little column by him where he suggested that the British should turn off the flow of intelligence to Washington for a couple days, just to make a point. Sanctions and embargoes, this is clearly when Europe uses the tools of trade politics to put some pressure or to send a larger signal beyond pressure, beyond the trade area. When the United States put tariffs up on steel, the EU responded with a kind of overreaction if it were simply on trade issues, but it was clearly sending a signal in threatening tariffs and retaliatory measures that would strike at key states within the United States that were sensitive to the Bush administration. That's politics, and that's trying to deal with this Mr. Big. Log rolling is another strategy of dealing with America. Putin is the master of this strategy. He's got his own agenda, He doesn't necessarily like American unipolarity, but he'll trade some cooperation or accommodation for it, for American acquiescence in something that he cares about, such as Chechnya. And then finally, a weapon of resistance, threatening to withhold legitimacy. It's the toughest one to engage in. I think Chirac was basically arguing this, in saying, we don't think American war in Iraq is legitimate, full stop. And to the extent that creates pressure on the United States to bend over backwards, to go through diplomatic processes, or lays down a kind of marker for a future negotiation, that is part of using legitimacy, using the rules that already exist for putting some restraint on America. Now, there are dangers in this, and I think Schroeder is a good example of a chancellor who went overboard on this, and his credibility of talking about resisting the war backfired in some sense, and he was not taken seriously. It was seen as too parochial, too much a kind of political expedient, and not really truly a legitimacy complaint. Now, very quickly, strategies of accommodation. I have a shorter list. One is simply appeasement, which is to say a strategy of not showing resistance, keeping your powder dry, waiting for a better day. I think this is China, which is basically saying, you know, we would be flattened by the United States today. There's nothing to be gained for trying to lead a coalition that won't materialize. Let's roll with the punches, get what we can from it. After all, we thought we were going to be the target of the Bush administration when he was elected president. We thought the new Cold War would be against us, and lo and behold, President Bush found the axis of evil. You know, whew, you know, we dodged a bullet on that one. So in some sense, there's a certain relief, you might say, of living within a unipolar order where the United States, where the unipole is preoccupied with other areas. But the logic is to play for time until future administrations alter policies. Another strategy which I find fascinating is developing functional interdependence. That is to say, build mutual dependencies, build hierarchy into the system. Let me make a kind of theory point about this very briefly. We have a basic conviction in international relations that because the world is anarchic, because there's no world government, it's always in the, there's an enduring deep incentive for countries to remain autonomous from other countries. Getting too dependent on other countries is dangerous because in the final instance, you can never guarantee that that other country that you're dependent on will be your friend. So anarchy reinforces autonomy. But if I'm right that the structure of power is different and that American unipolarity is durable and it's backed up by things like nuclear weapons that make conquest less likely by the unipolar state, there's a kind of flipping point, and no longer do you have a resistance to hierarchy and interdependence, you have an actual dominant incentive to build it into the system. If you are a small state, you want to build a kind of weave a set of relationships that makes that powerful state dependent on you for niche operations in one way or another. The Japanese are trying to do this. One Japanese diplomat told me, we're trying to make the U.S.-Japan alliance sort of market-friendly to Washington, to make it look like it's good for America's interest to work through the U.S.-Japan alliance as it operates in East Asia. And the British as well have a clearly found niches in special operations, in rapid reaction forces, and NATO more generally. You can read the recent decision by NATO to develop a rapid reaction force, in effect to make Europe European forces indispensable to Washington in the years going forward. There's reason to think that this has been behind the European decision to get involved in Kosovo and other sort of post-conflict situations, to get into the game, thereby creating mutual dependencies and not just one-sided dependencies. The next strategy, bonding, that's the Blair strategy of getting into the inner circle, going overboard with cooperation, looking for voice opportunities. And then finally, and this leads me to my last set of comments, going back to the great strategy that the United States has from time to time been willing to take up, and that is institutional binding. That the greatest and most desirable strategy, if you are a weak state today, is to get the United States to act multilaterally, to create bargains that make the United States willing to exchange some autonomy for cooperation from other states. And this is what I want to end on by returning to my fourth set of comments and my last question, which is today's rising unipolar power rendering multilateralism and rule-based order untenable? The new unilateralism coming out of the Bush administration would seem to make you think so. And having been spending the last year debating neoconservatives around the world, they are unilateralists. They don't like rules. John Bolton is the Undersecretary of the State Department for Arms Control. He doesn't believe in arms control. I won't even talk about Wolfowitz and Pearl. Although Pearl, one of his great gems is, well, if we're going to be crucified for being a hegemon, well, we damn well ought to act like one. Charles Krauthammer, the neocon pundit who writes for the Washington Post, I debated him last year in Washington, and I was talking about the importance of American power being seen as legitimate around the world, and his response was, legitimacy? What's that? If America cares about legitimacy, it's sending a signal of weakness. I thought to myself, well, this is sort of right out of Sharon's playbook. This is not the America that I know. There is a unilateral agenda that is based on a deep skepticism of rules and institutions, particularly those that would impede the United States doing its neoconservative agenda, which is to remake the Middle East and to redeploy American power so that it can act as a kind of global superstate. Certainly, if that agenda succeeds, we are in a different world, and it is no longer the world of American power tied to rules and institutions. But I am doubtful that this is the history that we are going to see unfold in the years ahead. Unipolarity does make it easier for the United States to ignore other states and to resist cooperation. It increases the importance, moreover, of ideas and ideologies within the Beltway of Washington. If you are, even if by accident, find yourself in the cockpit of unipolarity, what you think, the baggage you bring from graduate school or from the book you read last summer at the beach, whatever your ideas are, will have a huge impact disproportionate to the ideas and ideologies of people who are in other capitals of the world, or certainly people who are out of government. So there's no question that unipolarity is going to take the world on an interesting ride, a ride where the ideas of particular individuals who have the president's ear or the chairman of a particular committee in Congress will have power and the opportunity to disrupt affairs in other countries that's wildly out of proportion. And that certainly would make people around the world long for the days of multipolarity. Yet the new unilateralism, in my view, does not constitute a fundamental shift in U.S. policy. It is not an attack on the deeper multilateralism of the post-war order, Bretton Woods, GATT and the WTO, and even, I would argue, collective security. There's unilateralism across that one sees from time to time, even important unilateralism dealing with the use of force, but the deeper forms of multilateralism that create structural ties in the international order, I think, are still there. The two, if you will, kind of characteristics of that deeper multipolarity are the indivisibility of economic relations and the indivisibility of security ties. That is to say, we are still tied together in a security community, and we are still tied together through open markets that could only be replaced if we, on the one hand, broke into security blocks, and on the other hand, if we broke into economic blocks. Neither of those outcomes are outcomes that even the most hardline neoconservative hawk unilateralist wishes for. And even if they did, I doubt that they would get it. A lot of the new unilateralism is in areas that are more specific, in arms control and disarmament. This is where you find the most newness, if you will, in Washington. Because you have in power a group that has been in power once before, in the early Reagan years, that basically doesn't believe in arms control. and doesn't believe in paper agreements. One of the neocons I've debated, Max Boot, who I was at a conference with Rosemary Foote, but Max Boot gives the former pundit on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, argues that paper agreements, history shows, just don't work. Countries that threaten us might sign them but won't abide by them. Countries that will abide by them are countries that don't threaten us. And it's based on a deep reading of how the Cold War was won. The U.S. did two things in the Reagan years that won the Cold War. It heightened the ideological competition. It was the evil empire, and it increased defense spending and put a kind of heavy form of pressure on Gorbachev and the Soviet Union. That is the lesson that they learn and that they are using to formulate their unipolarity strategy of unilateralism. And they are back in office, and they are ignoring offers of arms control and are resisting new agreements, I've indicated earlier. Well, that is true, but they are a beltway ideological group that is in power sometimes and out of power in other times. That's not built into the structure of the system. That is the fact that voters in Florida voted a certain way, maybe accidentally elected Bush, and you got not only an accidental presidency, but then you got kind of almost accidental appointments. So this is not deep structure. As an academic, when I wake up in the morning, I look at the world and I look for deep structures and dynamics and rules of motion that go across decades and centuries. Believe me, I want to assign great deep causal value to the system to explain what's going on in Washington today, but I can't. I don't think it's rooted in those deep structures. It will go away. Another form of unilateralism is a little bit more durable. It's likely to be around for a while, and that is the new unilateralism that is a reaction to what I call the new multilateralism. That is to say, multilateralism that is more legal binding than in the past, which has fewer escape clauses, or doesn't entail weighted voting, or doesn't give the Security Council permanent members a veto right. The ICC is the best example of this. The U.S. resisting this form of new multilateralism that doesn't allow it to protect its own interests, if you will, in case there's a politically inspired indictment. And that means that the unilateralism, opposition to ICC, is coming from not a decision to roll back the multilateralism of the post-war era, but a resistance to the particularities of a new type of multilateralism that's being offered up. And my question to you in assessing whether the clash between America and the outside world on the question of new versus old multilateralism hinges on three questions: how much new multilateralism is out there and is likely to be out there in the years ahead? Is it really the ICC and that's it? Number two, how bridgeable is old and new? People tell me that there were very specific manipulations of the ICC, Rome Statute, that could have allowed for more safeguards and therefore American participation, certainly in a post-Bush administration. And then the third question is the United States always on the old multilateral side and the rest of the world on the new multilateral side? And the answer is no there as well. The WTO is the other great example of new multilateralism, and as we know, the United States is a great champion of the WTO. So in my view, there are reasons to think that the balance between unilateralism and multilateralism will be complicated. And let me end by suggesting there are three sources of multilateralism that America feels that will lead us to a future where American hegemony will continue to have liberal characteristics. Three deep forces that encourage the U.S. to act multilaterally. One is the functional imperatives of globalization. That is to say, as economic integration goes up, the need for multilateral cooperation goes up. Or to put it a different way, as interdependence rises, the opportunity costs of not coordinating your policies go up relative to the lost autonomy associated with binding agreements. So with greater globalization, which may in fact be a manifestation of American power in part, supported by it, you get
kind of a positive feedback loop leading the United States to look for more agreements, more rules, more opportunities to coordinate policy through rules and institutions. The United States had a massive self-interest in, after World War II, in creating an open global economy, and it was willing to create rules that created politics of institutions that it was vulnerable to in return for that openness, and that will continue. The second deep force encouraging multilateralism is the one that I've spent the most time on over the years, which is what I would call hegemonic power management. That is to say, as a leading country, multilateralism is a critical tool for three things. Number one, reducing enforcement costs, to use a social science jargon. That is to say, if you can get other countries to buy into a set of rules and institutions, you don't have to spend every day using your power, which you do have and you could use, to get those countries to act as you want them to. If they buy into rules and institutions, ones that you like and ones that you have some escape from in the final instance, you are using institutions for a very sophisticated type of power exercise, namely political control. Secondly, you are locking in those countries to an order that's likely to persist even after your power wanes. That is to say, you are investing in your own future by creating rules and institutions as a powerful state. And thirdly, you are making your power along the way more legitimate and therefore more durable, which is to say you are reducing the so-called drag on the exercise of your power, and you are creating an order where other countries are operating with you because they see it as something that's in their interest as well. I think that those are incentives that the Bush administration doesn't feel very strongly today. And I'll just as a final aside, my book After Victory, I was asked by Richard Haass, the director of policy planning at the State Department, the office that George Kennan first headed, the policy planning staff at the State Department. He asked me to come and give a talk about my book, indicating what my book says Bush foreign policy should be. And I said, Richard, I'd be glad to do that, but I don't think you're going to want to hear what I have to say. Essentially, reverse every policy that you are currently pursuing. I don't think that this administration has a rounded sense of power, which is odd and perhaps ironic because this is the crowd that campaigned for the presidency under the banner of a kind of new realism, that it was the Clinton administration, in their view, that didn't understand power realities, that the realists, the mature, the adult supervision was coming back to that the true wielders of power that only reside in the Republican Party and has been missing in the Democratic Party as far back as George McGovern and onward, backward, are poor stewards of American power and interest. But in an odd, ironic way, there are missing dimensions of power that I would suggest are more rooted in the ideologies and post-Clinton vagaries of power than it is in a kind of new American orientation. John Bolton does not speak for America. Finally, the third source, the American national tradition, based on rule of law and civic identity. To be sure, there's lots of political impulses and ideological impulses in the American political tradition. Isolationist, internationalist, unilateralist, the new sovereignists. All of these different impulses are there. Some talk about the Jacksonians, the Hamiltonians, the Wilsonians, and others. They're all there, to be sure. Yet, the United States and its own image of its own political order, which was founded on a kind of image of rights and obligations embedded in rules, and indeed in the Constitution, is a civic-based political framework that suggests that abstract rules are what keeps us together. Abiding faith in rules that we all share and legitimate institutions is what allows the American system to hold together despite its heterogeneity of religions and ethnicities and races and regions and classes. All of that is held together because of abstract things that are in our heads, and a commitment that that they work, and experience that suggests that that's how you build order that lasts. And there is, even though it's resisted at times and bypassed at other times, this kind of civic nationalism and rule of law, which has been used to form the American system, creeps into the way in which we think about the outside world. And it's there across the political spectrum and across history. It's interesting. I think, in thinking back at the last great moment of transition, or great global transition after World War II, who were the stewards, the American stewards of that transition? Well, one of them was Harry Truman. For 50 years, Harry Truman kept a little poem in his wallet, a poem by Tennyson that was a kind of ode to world humanity and universal rights, and the dream of a kind of Kantian dream, if you will, of a kind of unity of mankind made good by rules and democracy. And that little card was in his wallet on April 12th, when he suddenly became, of 1945, when he became president and didn't know a thing about what was going on. But one thing he knew, his first decision was to announce to the public that the San Francisco conference on the drafting and ratification of a charter for the United Nations would go forward. That's the first decision he made. And it was built, although he was a realist and a hard-nosed steward of the American national interest, he made a commitment to putting American power at the service of building a universal institution that would provide some girding for peace and security. Now, we all know the travails that followed, but that's in the American DNA, I would say, and I think it will reappear in the years going forward. So thank you very much.
You'll rarely hear such a detailed, sweeping argument in such a hot room, and I can see many of you are suffering. But it wouldn't be complete this evening if we didn't take it now as our turn to turn the tables a little bit on this thesis. So given it's the exam season, your task is to critically evaluate and assess Professor Eikenberry's thesis in terms of coherence, some questions there, empirical adequacy and theoretical sophistication. You can do all that well, you can have my job. You can take questions in clusters of five to get a real sense of how we want to relate to this broad argument. And I'd like questions to be quite sharp, given that it is very hot and getting late. So let's have five questions. Number one.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you very much for an interesting lecture. John, I'm sorry I came in late, but coming in late should invalidate criticism, but I'm afraid it won't. Let me try and make the brief point that maybe you're falling into the trap of solipsism here, of assuming, perhaps with American foreign policymakers, that America is all that matters in the world. Now, this seems a stupid point to make in the aftermath of a war in which clearly half the world has been thinking about President Bush and American policy, and clearly a lot of people are extremely angry with American policy, and it'd be stupid to deny that almost every policymaker in every country has to factor the United States into its calculations on most of its foreign policy issues. But still, the system is extremely patchy. We academics use the term order or system all the time to imply that there is something which can be managed, and that the United States is the obvious hegemon, the potential manager at the moment. Maybe we shouldn't conceptualize it like that. Maybe if you're in South Africa, you're concerned with relations with Angola, you're in the Maghreb, you're in the middle of the Algerian civil war, or even in Europe wondering about the convention. Actually, the United States is not always right in the front of your mental picture, nor need it be. And to finish, I think that both the neocons and the liberal multilateralists, in a way, are ambivalent about putting the Americans right at the forefront all the time. They sense this issue. The liberal multilateralists, naturally, because they make concessions to saying we must share, we must be subject to rules just like everybody else. the neocons because there's an element of isolationism in them as well as the assertion of naked power. And it's that fault line, I think, in the present administration which may well be their downfall.
Thanks, John. Let me just tease out what I thought was the sort of, not the central flaw in your excellent lecture. You and I go back a long way, so I know exactly what you're saying. I think you know exactly what I'm going to ask, so perhaps this is just to share our little secrets with a larger audience. But it did seem to me you got to a point, I thought, where you had a problem. And that's where you got into this problem of contingency and accident. In other words, it seems to be central to your argument, which is a highly optimistic one from my perspective, and I think many people's in this hall's perspective, and no doubt many people in America's perspective as well. You have to argue, it seems to me, that what this administration represents is something really contingent and accidental, dependent on whatever happened in Florida, dependent on a whole series of circumstances. And obviously, in one sense, of course, the election, it wasn't just contingent on accident, it was essentially a coup d'etat, as far as I could see. Brought about by Florida and Sandra Day O'Connor and a Reaganite Supreme Court, but that's another issue. But that's not really the main question. What happens, I mean, what do you say to the argument that essentially this is not contingency? And in fact, going back to the origins of your argument about the power shift, I mean, this is surely the point of Robert Kagan and others, to say that what we're really seeing here is, okay, maybe contingent in the sense of an election, which was won in a peculiar way, but nevertheless, what you're really seeing here is an expression of a certain type of set of policies which express the very thing you talked about so eloquently at the beginning, namely this shift of power in the 1990s. And in other words, we're looking at something rather larger and structural, which of course leads us to rather more pessimistic conclusions than the one that you've actually suggested. And I thought really that was, in a way, a brilliant, typically brilliant presentation. That struck me as the way you got out of jail. You provided a large structural analysis, but in the end you had to come down to say that really the policies of this administration really are only short-term. If, however, they are the expressions of something deeper and more profound, which you yourself have analysed very, very well, both in your writings and in this lecture today, then I think you have a problem with your argument in the end. That's my basic point. Thank you very much, John, and thanks for a great lecture.
It seemed to me that the heart of your presentation was the idea of liberalism and following rules. And in that, you present the Bush administration as being a divergence from that. It seems to me that you could read history quite differently and say that right from the start, indeed, and see this as a kind of crisis of liberalism, that right from the start with the Declaration of Independence, the leaders of opinion had to manufacture an enemy, George III, to justify their creation of a new state. That throughout the American experience that's been done in South America to justify interventions, it was done against Germany in World War I. But what we're actually seeing with the Bush administration and its willingness to define an emergency is precisely the fact that liberalism has to constantly hide the fact that the interpreters of the rules exercise an arbitrary power. And that what we really want, and probably what Americans should be thinking of in terms now, is a democratic moment where we say these people who redefine the rules have to be held accountable. So I just don't accept that you can draw this neat distinction between liberalism as rule-following and then the Bush administration as being, you know, the wild men outside that.
Anybody on the left? Yeah.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for your lecture. My name's Ian Bolton, no relation. What I was curious about is you made reference to the multilateral system of trade and how this can constrain American power. But given the mutual interdependence, it would be difficult then for Europe to use it as leverage on the United States, since they also depend upon this system. And in some way then it permits American unilateral action in Iraq, as if the Europeans see this as a way of constraining them it is not an effective means. And the other question I had for you was, if we are to see the United States as a preeminent military power, thus far they have yet to sustain a controlled presence, really, in either of the cases of Afghanistan or Iraq. And in fact, in Afghanistan, seem to have tried to withdraw to a very residual presence, it seems, for the fears that of what they are suffering right now in Iraq. And given that these two countries were two of the weakest in the world, is it truly, can we say, a test of American power?
Great questions. There was a question over to the right.
Thank you. Two actually quite related questions to the previous speakers. The first refers to your understanding of the U.S. as a truly liberal hegemon, which is quite near to the formulation of a leading neocon, Robert Kagan, who sees it as a benevolent hegemon. Is this liberal hegemon, or this idea, compatible with the U.S. security strategy, with its emphasis on preemptive war and counterproliferation, and also attention to the prevention of the emergence of counter-hegemons or counterbalancing powers across the world? And this was related, again, to your comment about the U.S. not being threatening because of the possibility of nuclear war. Well, as we see, the U.S. is trying to prevent other states acquiring nuclear weapons. And the second related question is whether the debate is about how the U.S. proceeds about pursuing its aims, whether it's multilateral or unilateral, whether it's caught in a web of institutions or not, or whether the question is what are these aims, whether these aims are truly legitimate. And again, this is a quite interesting overlap with what the neoconservative authors say, because they say that Clinton, and they are no lovers of Clinton, of course, would have done precisely the same as George Bush, only perhaps in a more sophisticated manner.
I did see the incoming director of the LSE yesterday, and he asked me after his talk, did I have any comments, and I did just say one thing, air conditioning. So you have all my sympathy. Just would you say one more, and then can you give sharp responses?
Thanks. I will try to be very brief. I found your argument that hegemony is not necessarily incompatible with a rule-based order very powerful, but then should we not be debating about the content of the rules? And you have not been telling much about this. And of course, the U.S. had a very important role in creating the rule-based system after World War II, but it was a rule-based system in which the veto power of the U.S. was entrenched formally or informally. And you say something about the old and new multilateralism. Should this be meant as old, meaning rule with veto, with U.S. veto power, and the new multilateralism is the multilateralism in which veto power is eliminated? I mean, I think that focusing a bit more on the specific contents of the rule would be very important at this stage, and this might be actually the center of the debate between the United States and other people around the world.
Perhaps I can just toss in one small comment that builds on some of the remarks that have been made. You talk about three checks, as it were, to American unipolar developments, functional imperatives and so on. But couldn't you argue that America, by virtue of your first half an hour remarks, that the U.S. is so powerful now that it can shape globalization in its own image? I think up till now, globalization has been much more than Americanization. But you see this going on at the heart of one of the areas you talked about, trade negotiations and trade power. The Doha round, if it is to be a success, has to be a development round that brings real benefits to the world's poorest countries. But I think the current administration would most like the Doha round to be an extension of free trade agreements without it being a development round. Now, how could it shape globalization to that end? It can do so because it has access to and controls so many powerful markets. If it can lock other countries into those markets, it can bypass, in some senses, the WTO Doha trade round or present the Doha round with a fait accompli. How could you measure that? The growth of bilateral agreements between the US and its key alternative and its key markets. And there's a great growth in bilateral initiatives at this time, and those initiatives are underpinned by a rigorous enforcement of the WTO rules, a very narrow reading of what they are, which locks straight into the American vision of globalization. So it looks like these functional imperatives can be reshaped by the, as it were, the core nature of this growth of a unipolar power, and it may not provide the restraint you think. But let's hope I'm wrong.
Okay, these are great questions.
And cool.
You know, I think, you know, my basic thesis is that the way American power is manifest in the world is benign enough to make it undesirable for countries to try to conceive of an alternative world where it built on kind of a balance against it. And secondly, American power is sufficiently multidimensional and deeply rooted in the project of modernity that is likely to be around for a long time. That is to say, unipolarity will be quite durable and be a core feature of this global system for a long time. None of these questions, I think, really challenge either of those two main theses. But they get at how we code the current Bush administration, and whether it might suggest evidence that unipolarity is leading in some other direction, and that I think Mick's question and several others get at this question, how to think about the Bush administration and the later question on how compatible is its national security strategy for a liberal hegemony. I guess my, sort of inside of my argument is the view that this agenda that has emerged in the Bush administration in the wake of 9/11, which is articulated in the national security strategy, which is an imperial hegemonic project, is unsustainable. It's going to kind of burn itself out in a variety of different ways. So we're sort of seeing this kind of set of active, ideologically driven initiatives, but they're kind of finding their limits as we go forward. As one speaker suggested, there are limits to how much you can invade countries, overturn regimes, and build durable states in their wake that don't continue the cost a lot to run. And I think even while the neocons and the hardliners would say Iraq was a success, I think there's a certain sobriety one would suspect is creeping into even their councils as they think about the ambiguities and complexities of trying to keep Iraq together. I think that will have that will have some weight on whether they think that the future will entail more Iraqs and more of this kind of American unilateral military structuring of world politics. So the other way, it's politically unsustainable in other ways as well. The American people don't want to pay the bill for these sorts of adventures. It's unsustainable in the sense that I think that the costs in the form of resistance by other countries is greater than many people in the Bush administration thought. I don't think they anticipated that the debate in the Security Council this spring would be as acrimonious as it was, and they didn't think that even countries like Canada, Mexico, and Chile would not find it in their interest to vote in favor of the American position. I mean, that's striking. And for those, that's a cost that they did not expect. That's a cost of this strategy. So I am suggesting that there's a kind of life cycle or kind of arc to this post 9/11 militarization of American foreign policy and unilateralization of American foreign policy. And that's embedded in my argument that the kind of the longer continuity of a kind of institutionalized hegemonic order around liberal characteristics will prevail. Mick, I think, it's who knows what Gore would have done. That's one way to kind of ask the question, a different president, would he have done the same things, or she? I think the answer is yes, Afghanistan, but probably not Iraq, or not Iraq in the same way. There is some evidence that Iraq could have unfolded in a way that would have been consistent with the kind of UN-based, mutual agreement on principles of use of force basis. Even the French, I think, there's some indication would have, if inspections would have been allowed to run into the fall, would have signed on to some agreement that would have led them to acquiesce and use of force, perhaps even been there. Their only battleship was on the way to the Eastern Mediterranean. There was some sense that there were outcomes that would have led them into that war. Then finally, just on the questions of checks and sort of the economic dimension of things, there are several questions on that. I think that it's hard for any country to use economic weapons against a powerful state because it also entails equally sizable costs on their part and perhaps even greater costs because they are smaller states. I think you have to see it as sending signals as opposed to making actual material damages. I really think that's what the EU is doing in its reaction to the steel tariff issue. They were saying, you know, they're sending a signal that said, you know, we are willing to put at risk our own interests to make it clear to you that we do not want abusive trade policy coming out of Washington. I'll have to think about David's question about the Doha round and globalization.
It's very pessimistic.
It's a pessimistic. I'm pessimistic on the issue of whether the Doha round will do much on the developing country side of things. I think the single most important thing that can be done is on agriculture, and that's quite frankly that's not a unipolar issue. That's also it's even more a European French issue. And the single most important thing that could be done for the OECD countries spend billions of dollars a year protecting themselves from cheaper agricultural imports from the developing world, and that's where the most bang for the buck would occur. And that is that's not a power unipolar power issue. I could be pessimistic on that, but not on the implications it may have for unipolarity.
It's 8 o'clock. I mean, I think we could go on all night on these very big issues with such a sort of tight analytical presentation and excellent questions. But from here, you look like you've had it. It's too hot. The debate is important, but so is getting outside. So just join with me for thanking John very much for his lecture.